Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Nick Apps, and I'm the head of the program committee here at Prairie. And thanks to everybody for coming out this Sunday, even though I'm sure we're all anticipating that winter is going to continue to make up for lost time at some point. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded community. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, every color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We strive to be a welcoming congregation, no matter your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite any visitors and guests that may be here today, and also returning friends whom we haven't seen in a while, to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services here at Prairie, and they are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, as we have today, eventually, if we do have a minister again, that minister will be presenting, presumably. Well, now is the time for our presentation. Today's presentation is entitled Bullies, Victims, and Bystanders in Schools, presented by Dr. Amy Belmore. Dr. Belmore is an assistant professor of human development in the Department of Educational Psychology here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She received her doctorate in developmental psychology from the University of Connecticut, and following her graduate studies, she completed postdoctoral training in the Department of Education at UCLA. Her primary research interest is how school-based peer relationships influence adolescent development, and she'll be giving this presentation as the first in Prairie's series of programs on parenting. So please welcome Dr. Amy Belmore.
Thank you so much for having me. So just to preview, so I'm a professor by nature, so I'm here to present information. That's the way sort of I view what I do. And within that, I also use a lot of numbers and facts and figures, so that's the way I'll be presenting this, but we can have a conversation about it afterwards. I want to begin by defining what bullying is and what we mean by bullying. As psychologists, we actually have a very specific definition, even though this is a term that is really prevalent within our society today. When we talk about bullying, we mean it as this. So a student is being bullied or victimized when he or she is being exposed repeatedly and over time to negative actions on the part of one or more other students. And in order to use the term bullying, there should be an imbalance in strength or an asymmetric power relationship. So there are a couple of things that are important about this definition. One is that notice it's referring to students. That's not a requirement, but this idea of bullying came to attention because of what happens within peer groups, within school settings. So it's not a requirement that this only occurs between students. This could take place in a neighborhood or could take place between siblings even or between parents and children. But the other parts are important. So the first is this notion that it's something that happens repeatedly and over time. So the idea is to differentiate this from just one single event, which certainly we could describe as victimization, but it wouldn't get classified as bullying. This idea is actually being challenged today. People say, well, one event could really be extreme, and so why does it have to happen repeatedly? So people are sort of debating that part of this definition. The other part, though, is not up for debate. So the idea that there's an asymmetry in the relationship, and the notion here is that one person is really targeting another person. So in this little drawing here, you see that there's someone who is targeting the other person. And the idea is that the asymmetry comes from the event. So two people might be equals in a classroom setting where a teacher is in charge and they can supervise what's going on, but those same two students out on the playground, then there might be an asymmetry where one person, maybe because they're bigger, or maybe because they're just more aggressive, will target another person. And so that's where we see the asymmetry, and that's when we would define it as bullying. The behaviors that we use to define bullying won't be all that surprising to you. We define bullying as including physically aggressive acts, things like hitting, kicking, and shoving, verbally aggressive acts, which are by far the most common acts that kids report experiencing or that they report engaging in. And this is because we have fewer sanctions about these in schools, so these include things like teasing and name-calling, insults and ridicule. And then there's a whole other class of behaviors that within the past 15 years or so have gotten more attention. And these are nonverbal and non-physical in nature, but they include things like being the subject of rumors and gossip, being excluded or isolated from events. So this could take place. So say there's a birthday party and the student lets everybody know, you're all invited except this person. So being excluded in that way, or being isolated on the playground are examples of that. Having your property stolen or damaged, and a lot of times this takes place with kids in the forms of sort of like keep away. Someone will grab a backpack or a hat or something and keep it away from the student for a while. And then also gestures get included in this category. A lot of people are paying attention to cyberbullying now, and that phenomenon isn't distinct from any of these, except for the physical forms. It actually is just a different venue. So the verbal aggression and the sort of rumors and gossip and isolation, all of that can occur within the context of cyberbullying or within face-to-face bullying. Okay. In terms of how common it is, it's actually remarkably common. So 70% of middle school and high school students report that they have been bullied at some point in their secondary school year. So while they've been a middle school student or a high school student, they can report that it has happened to them. On the other end of things, in terms of who's perpetrating these actions, again, a large proportion of kids have said that they've either initiated a bullying action or taken part in bullying in some way within the past school year. So 20 to 40% of kids, that's a big range. And this is based on a nationally representative US sample. In terms of the kids we worry most about, though, we call these kids the chronic victims and chronic bullies, and these are the students who are exposed to this, the repetitive actions. And these are also fairly large percentages of kids, so 5 to 15% of any kids, if you think about a classroom of kids, 5 to 15% of them might be chronic victims, and 7 to 12% chronic bullies. However, what I want to leave you with the impression with today is that it's not just the bullies and victims that we need to think about. Actually, all of the kids in a peer group where this is occurring are impacted. So certainly, we can worry about bullies and victims, but we also need to think about other kids. So we define kids who don't initiate the bullying but join in with the bullying as assistants. So they would have otherwise not targeted a kid, but if their friend is making fun of someone, maybe they start to join in with that kid, and we label them as assistants. Reinforcers are maybe the more insidious kids, because these are kids who don't initiate and don't actually directly ever target anybody, but they sort of egg the bully on. So they might be laughing at what's going on, and the consequence here is that then the bully is sort of getting what they're after. So they might then escalate the event and make it worse, or they might continue to do it on a more continuous basis day to day. On the victim's end of things, we have kids who might step up and help the victim. And this is really, I think, what we want to promote as psychologists, and this is really where we're directing our intervention efforts today. So I'll talk a little bit about how we can get more kids to step in and be defenders. But they're also sort of everybody else. And we label these individuals bystanders. So these are kids who usually directly witness the event but don't become involved in any way. Or they might hear about the event later on, so they might never actually see a bully targeting a victim, but they know sort of who has a reputation as a bully or a victim because they hear about these events. And so they're aware that it's going on within their context. Okay. So I've done a lot of research asking kids to describe what exactly it is that happens to them or what they see going on in their schools to try to understand the phenomenon and how best we can shape their the interpretations that they make about the events and sort of help them want to intervene when they see things happening. And I'm always struck by sort of how readily they can just describe events that to us as adults don't happen to us in day-to-day life, and they might not seem all that extreme. So for example, one boy who's a middle school student wrote, I was just walking quickly to period three, so I didn't see much. What I did see was that an older-looking boy tripped a kid, probably to impress his friends. The friends started laughing. I'm not sure if anything else happened because I had already passed. So this is not that extreme. A student is getting tripped, but this witness is describing this as a bullying event, and he also demonstrates a lot of insight into what is happening. So he's saying the bully's probably doing it to impress his friends, and in fact, the friends are laughing. And so there's this sort of implicit reinforcement of the behavior, and so you know, this boy who's passing on his way onto period three really doesn't have an incentive to step up and intervene. Another student wrote about something more extreme. This kid was walking, but then these other kids surrounded him and said something I couldn't hear and pushed him to the ground and threw away his food, then kicked him and left. So this is quite extreme. And you'll notice here that this student doesn't explain, I stepped in, I tried to do anything, or I told a teacher about it, or that a teacher stepped in, or that other kids were there to help. Really, in these events, and kids could describe these events in whatever way they chose, they really just focused on, I saw this happening, and really no one came to this student's aid in this instance. And this is certainly, whenever physical forms of aggression are involved, this is when we would expect teachers or adults to intervene, but it's not happening here. Okay, so then the question I think that should be asked, or that I'm asking, is who can students count on? Are there people in their environment who will help them when they're bullied? And in fact, most students report that no one came to their aid when they were picked on. And again, this is based on asking students at the end of the school day, tell us, did anything happen to you today? And then, did anybody help you? And 64% of the students said that no one helped them. 32% of the students said another student helped them. And the important part here is that 100% of that time, of those 32%, it was a friend of theirs. So it's not that just another passerby or a kid that they know from class is likely to step in. It's really only a student's friends who are willing to step up and defend them. In terms of what those other students do when they step in to help, most often they confront the bully. And this usually takes the form of the defender saying to the bully, stop. And that's as far as it needs to go. Stop it, stop making fun of him. Those are the types of interventions that are extremely effective. So when that happens, the bullying, so people have done observational studies of this, and they've shown that the bullying stops within 10 seconds. Yeah, so that's not to say that it might not start up again later on in the day or in another setting, but in that event, it really stops. There are other things that witnesses can do, though, that I think that should arm children with. We should let them know you don't have to step in. So certainly we don't want kids to feel unsafe or that they need to sort of save the day in that way in the moment. They can tell an adult about it. So oftentimes this is a teacher, or they can tell their parents, or they can tell somebody else about it later on. And they can also offer comfort to the victim. So in that earlier slide where students are describing whether or not they got help, this included times when in the event nobody stepped up and did anything, but later on someone came up to them and said, I saw what was happening, that wasn't right, you know, it was wrong, how do you feel, and sort of checked up on them. And it's a really effective way of helping that might not be obvious to kids. Okay, so in terms of the implications of getting help, it's actually remarkable in the positive effects it has. So recall that when students get help, most often it was from another friend. So then we also measured when you got help, or if you didn't get help when you were victimized, how much depression were you feeling? So the outcomes that are associated with victimization are depression and anxiety and lower feelings of self-worth. Here we examine just depression. And this is a scale of 0 to 4, with 4, it's just more feelings. This isn't clinical levels of depression, this is just feeling bad about yourself or feeling bad in general. The scale only goes to 4, and you can see when kids are bullied and they don't receive any help, they're sort of almost at the top end of these feelings of depression. However, when they did receive help, those feelings of depression are remarkably alleviated. So much so that in fact that they don't differ statistically from kids who aren't picked on at all. So just having someone, you know, help you in that moment or later on offer comfort to you is really helpful to kids as they deal with individual bullying events. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the importance of friends just in general, because we don't really know for sure how that process works. But one thing we know is that having a friend will protect you from being targeted. So bullies are opportunists, and they look for sort of weakness. I put that in quotes because that can mean a bunch of different things, but one thing that might mean is just being alone. So having someone with you protects you from being targeted by a bully. This is probably the process that explains what was on the earlier slide. So having a peer who's empathic and can understand your feelings will make you feel less isolated about your experiences, and this is a really important effect. And then also, obviously, if you have friends, they're more likely to defend you from the bullying when it occurs, which is also represented on that slide. However, so I don't think I need to argue about the importance of friends, but I do want to introduce one slight caveat. So with kids, their relationships change a lot more than ours do as adults. So the stability of their friendships change, especially as they move maybe from one school to another school, as we have these normative transitions from elementary school to middle school and middle school to high school. So their friendships change. And so when a friendship goes awry, which is normal, those friends have important information about each other, and they can use that in ways to then target each other, maybe in, you know, meaner ways than people who don't know each other as well could. So there is the possibility that friends actually can turn on each other, and so that needs to be considered in this. Okay, so what about teachers and other adults? The amount of help that students reported getting from these individuals was very low. So only 4% of the instances. And the main reason for this is that most of the bullying happens when another adult is not present. So again, bullies are opportunists, and they're figuring out, when can I do this, when it will be effective. And for the most part, they're not doing it to get attention from an adult. They're doing it because of the reinforcement they get from their peers. And so they choose when to do this. And so most often, adults aren't present. But this, it doesn't mean that every time an adult was present that they intervened. There were also times when kids would describe adults as being present who didn't do anything. Okay, so I think to understand why it is that adults do anything, I want to present this scenario here to give you an idea of the complexities involved in figuring out who is a bystander and from whose point of view might be perceived as a bystander. So this is taken from a bullying website, Eyes on Bullying. In this scenario here, I'll read it for you, but you all can read it as well. So Daniel and Gabe were playing catch when Alex walked over. "Give me the ball," Alex demanded. Daniel held on to the ball. It was his. He'd brought it from home. Alex hadn't returned the ball he took from Daniel last week. "Give it to me," Alex demanded again. "We need a ball for our game." Daniel looked across the field where a group of boys waited for Alex to return. He looked toward the school where the after-school teachers were deep in conversation. And Daniel handed his ball to Alex. He knew he wouldn't see it again. So again, I think, you know, when we look at this as adults, we wouldn't necessarily think, oh, this is a bullying situation. But certainly, Daniel feels threatened in this situation. It's happened before where Alex has taken his ball from him. So I think, you know, in some ways, it does fit the criteria of bullying. And also, we can see that there are a lot of bystanders here. So certainly, Gabe, who is present, who is presumably Daniel's friend because they were playing catch together. The boys across the field who are waiting for Alex to return potentially are bystanders in this situation, and the after school teachers who are also present. So from Daniel's point of view, he might see all of these people in his setting and nobody's stepping up and telling, hey, Alex, knock it off, don't take the ball from him. And so Daniel feels like he has to give up the ball because, well, no one's saying that what he's doing is wrong, and so I don't have any other recourse than to give him the ball. However, from the people that I just named, from their perspective, Gabe might actually not know what's going on. He might not know the history of Alex having taken the ball before. He might not be paying attention to what he's saying right now, depending on how close he is in the game of catch. The boys across the field might have no clue what Alex is doing and how he's getting the ball from him. And the teachers, even though they're after-school teachers and it seems like part of their job might be paying attention to what's going on. Notice here it says deep in conversation, so they might actually have no awareness of what's going on. So from Daniel's point of view, it might look like nobody's stepping in to help me, and they're all aware of it, and that gives him the impression that, okay, people are allowing this, but actually from the other people's point of view, maybe they aren't truly bystanders and that they have no idea what's going on. So the idea here is just to show sort of how tricky it is to figure out who actually is the bystander and who knows about these events as they're occurring. Okay. So I want to present a little bit of more information about why kids do intervene, when it is that they intervene, or sorry, why they don't first, I guess. So the predominant reason that kids say that they don't intervene is because they don't want to be harmed. And usually this isn't physical harm, usually this is just to protect their sense of self. They don't want to be humiliated or embarrassed. They sort of don't want the bully to turn their attention to them in any way. And that's a reasonable motivation, that makes sense. And so then I think, you know, sort of my task is to help kids feel more empowered so that they don't feel unsafe in making and intervening in bullying situations. And it's certainly the role of teachers and other people within schools to give students the power so that they don't feel unsafe. Some of the other reasons that kids gave, though, for why they didn't intervene is that they trivialized the event. So they just said sort of like, oh, you know, that's not a big deal. So on that earlier slide, you can imagine that a bunch of kids will say, what? That's what just what Alex does. He just takes the ball from people. We just come to expect it. That's not a big thing. That's not bullying. Some kids would disassociate to the event, meaning that, well, this isn't my problem. So maybe that's what Gabe did. He said, this is, I'm just going to let Daniel deal with this. I don't have a problem with Alex. I'm just going to let him deal with it. They might be busy with another priority. So we heard that in the other examples where the student had to get on to his period three class, or the teachers, their priority is talking with each other, but nevertheless, they're busy doing something else. Responsibility transfer is sort of a phenomenon that has been studied a lot with adults, and the idea here is that when other people are around, maybe you say, well, it's up to them, it's the other person's responsibility. And certainly this might play a big role in the example there. So there were potentially three other bystanders. The teachers might be saying, well, maybe Gabe can help Daniel out. Gabe might be saying, ah, it's the teacher's responsibility to do something. They're the adults. And the boys might just be saying, you know, that Gabe or the teachers should step in if they think Alex is doing something inappropriate. One of the least common reasons, though, which was the reason that people had hypothesized kids don't intervene, is because they don't know what to do. So it's not the case that kids feel uncertain about what to do. They do know what the right thing to do is or what they should do, but they have other reasons, primarily that they want to stay safe themselves, for not intervening. Okay. When they do intervene, the reasons that students offered were more varied, so there was no predominant reason, and actually when I looked at these reasons and then I looked at the principles that you all promote and embrace, a bunch of the themes sort of overlapped. So these are things that seem to be that kids carry with themselves as they go about the day. So some kids reported that I helped, so I did intervene because I wanted to make the other student feel better. I wanted to alleviate that person's concern, or I felt empathy. I know what that feels like. I knew he was feeling bad. I wanted to do something to stop that. Some students talked specifically about because it was my friend, so that's why I did something. But then another group of students reported that it was just wrong. So the bullying was wrong, or it was wrong that the student is feeling bad. So they had this sense of what is right and what is wrong in social interactions, and that's what compelled them to act. The smallest group of kids reported that they did something because they knew what to do. And this is the group that I think might be sort of most interesting to sort of change. Because if we can give kids the skill to know what to do so that they can remain safe, so that we can sort of combine those two slides, that's when we're most likely to see intervention by these kids. Okay. So I'll just leave you then with a few themes that I'd like you to take from what I'm talking about today. So the first is that you should never ignore a bullying incident. So especially in the context of, we know that adults are very unlikely to see these even occurring, you're probably really unlikely to even hear about them occurring as well. So when you do hear about it, or when you do actually witness it, you should definitely intervene in some way. This then sort of, these follow from one another. You should set an example with your own behavior. So obviously, I don't need to tell you this, this means not engaging in bullying on your own, but more specifically, it means stepping in when you see something that is wrong. So third, sort of relating to this, when you hear about these events or you see these events, and this might be you see them on TV in a television program, or you see them in a movie, or you hear about something that gets publicized within the community or at a national level, to take those as teachable moments to talk about the implications of bullying and talk about sort of how universal the experience is and the implications it has for victims, but also what it is that kids can do to help kids who are being victimized. And what goes along with this then is thinking about all of the role players, so the bullies, the victims, and the bystanders, and us as adults, our job is to help kids think about all of the behaviors that they could use so that they don't feel like they just have one venue. So on the bully's end of things, we need to give them other methods than using aggression. On the victim's end of things, we need to think about how we can help them cope with victimization or how they can avoid being susceptible to being targeted by a bully. And then from the bystander's end of things, we need to think about how it is that we can help them feel like they know what they can do, so they know the right thing, they know what they can do, and they can remain safe as they're helping the victims of bullying. And I'm going to leave it right there. Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for some discussion and questions. I know there are probably a lot, so Peter has the microphone.
Yep, so I think, so part of this involves, this starts at the top down, right? So we have to have school cultures that don't permit bullying. That is much more the norm. So I've been studying this for 15 years, and every school that I go into now has some sort of bullying program, but that doesn't mean it alleviates it. We need to know for sure that there will be sanctions against bullies, and the bystander who steps up needs to know that someone's going to back them, and that needs to be an adult, at a minimum, hopefully it's their peers as well. So if the peers know this is a culture where this doesn't happen. But I think maybe a more strategic point of view, because I'm not someone who wants to confront people, I would opt for the other route. So comforting a victim later on, or talking about it with an adult or a teacher, letting my parents know about what's going on so that, you know, I am actively informing people who might have more power than me. I think those strategies, because they're shown to be just as effective, we should, you know, inform kids about those. Yep. Yeah, I think so. I have, in some ways, you know, I'm devoting all of my time to studying this, but I have a little bit of a negative point of view from the point of view of that we can stop bullying, right? So this is something that happens in every culture that we've studied. There's not a culture yet across the world where we've studied it that it hasn't happened. Happens sort of in the same percentages. So this is some sort of group-based phenomenon that happens when we get kids together. So I think the efforts then, if we can't prevent it completely, certainly, I mean, we should still try to stop it, but we also need to arm kids with coping strategies, ways of, you know, sort of making sense of the events that are happening to them, and also empowering these bystanders. So this is where I think really the power of other people coming in and sort of changing the culture of the peer group or of the school can be really powerful. So there are people testing this now, actually in Scandinavian countries and Finland in particular, to see if when we empower bystanders, what effects there will be. But beyond that, yeah, I agree with you. It's an impossible problem. So I think, so there are at least sort of two main emphases for people who study bullying. So there's tons of researchers studying aggression, but studying bullying in particular. So there's a group of people studying whether it's bullies lacking social skills and sort of the proper cognitions and emotional control. And they're focusing their intervention efforts there on bullies. And that includes sort of helping parents deal with their kids, sort of taking it from that angle. There's another group of researchers more sort of along the lines of the way that I have been trained, who understand this as bullies actually are quite skillful. So taking this, you know, social skills deficit approach won't work. It's actually these kids are figuring out, this is how I gain status, this is effective for me, it's giving me the rewards I want. It's not the rewards that adults think are important, but it's getting me what I want. So from that end of things, it's trickier, because then that really requires us as adults to come in and sort of infiltrate, you know, the norms and the values that kids have, and that's essentially impossible. If I, you know, we could do that effectively, I would be running an advertising company and making trillions of dollars infiltrating kids' norms and values. But so I think that two-pronged approach is the way to go, but I'm not sure that we'll ever effectively be able to get into those norms and values for the bullies. Yeah, that's a great point. So I should have said at the top, actually, these terms. So the term victimization, I like the term in some ways because it illustrates the severity of the action, but you're right in terms of labeling the student. So you touched on a couple of things. So the interpretation that the victim has that I am not being victimized by this, that it is the action of the other person, is critical for sort of, you know, healthy psychological adjustment and the correct interpretation of that event, because it, the actually the perpetrator is the person who is targeting the individual. It's, and so it changes the way that a person interprets that experience. So that's really important. The second part of that is none of these labels ever get used in a setting with school. So when we describe the events, we oftentimes actually don't even use the word bullying. So we just talk about specific behaviors. So actually now the word bullying is a buzzword in schools and kids have a meaning that they associate with that. But for the most part, we focus just on the actual specific behavior. So that's a great point about using these labels. I don't know what goes on in schools, if they actually are using the terms victim. So I can't speak to that. But when we go into schools, we don't use those words.
Well, due to time constraints, further comments and questions will have to wait until after the service. But thank you, Dr. Belmore. And once again, let's thank her for being here. Our closing words will be read by Heidi Hughes.
I've been actually very pleased to see how much awareness was raised around bullying and how deeply it affects everyone. You know, you don't have to be the loser kid in high school to be bullied. Bullying and being picked on comes in so many different forms. Lady Gaga.
Well, thanks to everybody for coming today. Please feel free to greet your neighbor, stay for coffee and companionship.